Okay, so we're starting this series, and that's DNA in Judaism. That's the first part of our Hot Topics in Halakha series. And we're going to see all the different areas that DNA relates to, where it comes up as a discussion, whether it's Halakha. We're going to do a little bit of Jewish philosophy as well, as far as the Kohen gene and different areas like that that are being discussed that are on the table now as well. What is DNA? So DNA, here is a basic definition, nucleic acid that carries the genetic information in the cell and is capable of self-replication and synthesis of RNA. DNA consists of two long chains of nucleotides, that's the famous helix that we know of, twisted into a double helix and joined by hydrogen bonds between the complementary bases, adenine, thymine, and many other different elements. The sequence of nucleotides determines individual hereditary characteristics. So DNA is the code. It's the matrix, so to speak, of the human body. And, you know, as far as relevant for us, DNA is in everything. But it is the composite and makeup which allows us to look the way we do, act the way we do in many senses of the word. And therefore, it has a huge impact in our self-definition. So because of that, we have to ask ourselves, how does Judaism view DNA, one, as a piece of evidence, as a way of identification, paternity, many other issues, at least 15 areas where DNA becomes relevant. And the first one I want to discuss today is the situation of DNA and the aguna. DNA and the aguna. What's an aguna? You know what aguna is? Simply state, what is it, Dan?
Simply state, it's a woman whose husband is recalcitrant and giving a divorce.
Right. Husband is not giving her a divorce, or husband is unable to give a divorce. Can't find him.
Oh.
We assume aguna just means someone who's being a lowlife.
Can't get a divorce.
Well, maybe it's the guy went AWOL. So the technical word aguna comes from ugain, which means an anchor.
Ogain
is an anchor.
That's why they talk about stuff in the Talmud about getting lost at sea.
What? We're going to talk about that. Excellent. It's an interesting connection between the two. It's not even where it's connected, but that's an interesting connection. Ruth, the first reference to the word is Ruth, chapter 11, verse 13, where Naomi is giving, you know, her daughters-in-law Musar, what are you staying alone, like dead weight, like an anchor? Why should you stay? Ogain, why should you stay in this way? It's not good for you. Okay. We have it in context of a literal boat anchor. In the Talmud in Bava Basra, nothing to do with aguna, talking about boat anchors, really about moving property and not moving property, you have anchors. What's interesting is that we have no section of the Talmud, no Masechet in the Talmud called Masechta Agunas. We don't have it. There's Kiddushin, betrothal, there's Gittin, there's divorce, there's Yivamos, which deals with special types of arrangements where the brother has to step in and marry the one who's just lost her wife, but there's no separate tractate called Maseches Agunos. We don't have it. We just don't have it, which tells us something very interesting about the Aguna problem. It could be that this issue was not initially widespread. Now, why do I believe that to be the case? Because all the material that we find for Agunos is limited to three chapters in the Talmud. The 10th chapter of Yevamos, the 15th chapter of Yevamos, and the 16th chapter of Yevamos. It's all in that area. That's the lion's share of the material. It continued that way because if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, the Jewish body of law, guess how many sections are devoted to the laws of Aguna?
Maybe one or two.
One. Simen Yud Zayin. 17. It's section 17. That's it. Of Evin Ezer. Of Evin Ezer. Shulchan Aruch, Evin Ezer. That's it. That's all it is. You can find it only in one siman. Which is why when you're quoting the halacha, if you see in many of the books that quote the halachas that deal with agunos, many of the sfarim don't even bother quoting the siman for you. Because everyone knows. It's in one place. You don't have to go fishing around. They got to tell you 413 section. It's in one place. It's long section, but it's just one. So the question is, if you open up the rabbinic literature over the last 200 years, last 150 years, suddenly an explosion. And it becomes the most prolific area of Jewish law. Arguably, the most prolific area of Jewish law is the aguna. What?
Doesn't tie to the Industrial Revolution.
Oh, possibly. Excellent, Dan. Excellent. What suddenly made it more written on than any other topic? One possibility is the traveling Jewish merchant Now, a Jew is wandering, a wandering Jew continuing to wander into other communities, able to go further now, Industrial Revolution. A train could take him further. He can go get a job overseas.
Well,
going to come back, make some money, right? Right?
Versus,
okay, go out of town, make some money, bring it back home. But suddenly he never reappears. Husband's gone. He had a terrible life before. He just never came back. Suddenly it's coming up because of that.
Or he sinks. That's
what?
A big... One of the issues is
sinks in the boat. Good. Excellent.
How long do you have to wait? Is 7 years.
But that doesn't explain to me why something changed, because that was always a problem. But you're saying the boats, I guess, got bigger, the possibility of sinking?
In an agrarian community, 98% of people
yeah.
didn't go anywhere.
Didn't go anywhere. Good. Excellent. Well said then.
And
very good.
And they're smaller. If they're in an urban community, it's a much bigger community.
And therefore more on the move.
More on the move.
More on the move.
But soldiers weren't lost in battle?
What? Oh,
soldiers.
So warfare. Warfare got more complex.
Have witnesses.
The wars got bigger areas. The ways in which people can be shot at, harmed, left you with the question of did he die or did he not die? I don't know what happened. There was a huge fire. A whole city was bombed. Now he's missing. Those possibilities weren't there before. Warfare was hand-to-hand combat. A spear, you found them on the floor. People are blown up in ways you can't even find bodies afterwards, unfortunately.
That's why in the Talmud they use the ship, because the dilemma with that is there's no witnesses.
Right. Okay, we're gonna look at those different sections. Good. So then there's the issue of the Holocaust as well. Holocaust as well. It created so many situations that needed to be dealt with. By the way, we could divert and just do a guna for 12 weeks. If not more, if the focus were not DNA.
You did it already.
When do we do a guna?
Remember when I suggested the topic of Hafkat Kiddushin?
Oh, we did one on Hafkat Kiddushin. That's not a guna. That's one specific angle in the way people are annulling marriages. But you see, it's only one piece. That took us two classes. To do an aguna, we could do a 12, 14-part series. It might be kedai to write down these subtopics on the top in case you want to revisit them, but while staying on course to DNA. So... the fascinating thing about the laws of Aguna, it's the only halacha that the rabbis need to paskin with a lack of knowledge. Meaning, they don't know for certain if the person's dead or not. They don't know for certain the terms under which the person left. So much is still left to guesswork when deciding the halacha in a situation of Aguna, of a woman left without a get. Many of the times we have to be lenient. It's all based on us guessing situations or playing probability. There's no other halachas like that. Is the lulav kosher or not? Let's guess if the lulav that they had. Look at it and tell. Is it kosher or is it not? Is this animal kosher? Look and tell. Is it kosher or is it not? Who is the thief in a certain situation? You have witnesses. Come and give the testimony. By agunas, there's no other area of Jewish law where the rabbis are going walking in the dark and paskining in the dark. That's what they have to do. We don't know the facts. We have to make assumptions. And we can never be sure. We'll always remain in doubt. In the case of Aguna, many instances where you're solving an Aguna case, there always is that lingering doubt beneath the surface.
So that's always with a missing husband,
yes,
and not the recalcitrant.
Is there time, though, a factor, though?
There
yes,
is time. Time is an issue. Good. Time is an issue. It helps us a little bit. It's not the defining factor, but it's one of those things we have to throw in there. And the reason we play with all these weak things, time should make a difference. The guy who wants to leave his wife could leave for 40 years. All these things that seem a little weak is because, as the Talmud says, Mishum iguna ikilu bei rabbanan.
But it only went one way. What if the wife went missing?
Hold on. I'll give that in a second. One second. We have so many leniencies in this area because the Talmud says, because of the aguna, the rabbi had to be as lenient as possible. It's like mourning is like this as well. Avelus is always like the lenient position. This is the area where we try so hard, more than anywhere else, to find leniency. Because of the tragedy of the situation, we go farther than we usually need to go. By the husband, it's different. The way the Torah set it up is the one who gives the get is the husband, not the wife. She is just the receiver of the get, not the giver. It says, V'nosan biyada. Torah says, he gives her the get. He gives her the get. To level the playing field, the rabbis made a certain stringency.
But what if she's not there to receive it?
What?
I'm not talking about recalcitrance. What if she's literally not there to receive it? The wife went missing.
He's got to give it to her. He's got to give her the get. He's got to give her the gift. Vinasa Miyad, you're saying, she's gone. Okay, good.
But she's not there to accept
okay,
it.
So let's say if she's gone.
She can get remarried.
If she's gone. So if she's gone, we know, technically speaking, a Jewish man may marry more than one wife. So to level the playing field, polygamy was technically permissible. That was
then. Okay.
To level the playing field as much as possible, the rabbis created a couple extra laws to try to balance it out, to keep things in check. One of those laws was the Ashkenazi community, which accepted, you know, en masse, which was only one wife. That was one solution that was put in place. Number two, that a husband can't divorce a woman against her will. That was the second leverage move that was made. At the same time, you can't override everything that's in the Torah. So there is a escape route, so to speak, which is very expensive and seldom used. And should be used once in a lifetime, if that. And that's the Heter Meir Rabbanim, where the rabbis could, so to speak, allow, based on certain conditions, the other marriage to allow a certain leniency within the stringency of marrying more than one wife. And the reason they're able to do that, basically, is because it's not so clear that we still have that stringency today of only one wife. Because the Chayram de Rabbeinu Gershom, who enacted it, this sort of ran out. The time frame that was put in it, it needs to be reasserted. And it hasn't been officially, there's been no body of law to reassert it, just the minhag is we don't do it. We just don't do it. Technically speaking, we follow the law of the land. That's also part of the Torah, and therefore we can't marry more than one wife. So those are some just...
Well, I was thinking of the same period you were talking about with wars and stuff, when already polygamy was... I'm saying, does the man, if the wife...
There are so many fascinating cases here. I mean, I got...
But just generally, like if a wife's missing, is it the same, if there's a man's missing?
There'll usually be a leniency because, one, you're not dealing with a Torah prohibition. You just are not. To be honest, you're not dealing with a Torah prohibition. You're dealing with rabbinic creations of stringencies to leverage the playing field. So in a situation where she'll mamish be missing and there was good reason to think that she's gone, the leniencies will come even faster because you're dealing not with a Daraisa, you're dealing with a Darabana. Okay.
And maybe women went to war on ships last.
Yeah, that's true also. Now, the case, why I say that, and we try to turn heaven and earth over to be Matir and Aguna. They say Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector was called Avi HaAgunos, the father of the Agunos. He would spend all day and all night trying to find leniencies we can get there as well, but again, the focus is DNA, but which is part of it. We'll get that. I'll touch upon it. So now, I mean, the reason it's so dangerous, this whole thing, and why you have to go to an expert rabbi for this, is the famous situation that many people have heard of. It was the situation that actually came up in Bnei Brak, where after World War II, a woman got a heter, and that she was, based on her situations, based on the halachic reasoning, she was free to marry whoever she wanted. She starts a new life, has all these kids. 25 years later, based on sophisticated database and the Holocaust museums, her old husband shows up. He's still alive. He's still alive. He thought she died. She thought he died. He's still there. She started a new family, new children, new everything. It doesn't make a difference if Rav Moshe Feinstein let her marry, the Satmar Rav let her marry, every single heavy hitter agreeing. You can't change the fact that those children aren't from Zera. She was a married woman.
They are.
That's why this topic is so dangerous and so difficult.
You
better hope that he really died after the Yemer. Unfortunately, very, very, very difficult situations. Very, sometimes Jewish law is what's called din kasha, the Zohar says. It's tough. It's not always, kumzitz and karabach. It's sometimes hard.
So nobody came out after the Holocaust and provided some kind of ruling?
That what?
The presumption of death.
Yeah, I'm saying they allowed this woman to get married. They gave based on her situations.
Each
situation has to be viewed on its own. What were the circumstances? Where were the person lost? Where did they not see them? You assume many of the people who they couldn't find years after were dead. But the problem is he showed up. He did show up. And all the presumptions and statements you could make and declarations mean nothing if he shows up.
Was it not possible to create a permanent halakhic framework?
It's impossible. If he shows up, he shows up.
No, I'm asking
a standard that you just plug in where he was?
Yeah.
I mean, you could use basic assumptions, but whenever you're playing around with the laws of Aguna, you have to judge each case on its own.
Some sock that says if they've been gone for X amount of years, they're assumed to be dead permanently.
Not one factor was the defining factor. They're all what's called in halakha a snif lahakel. Another angle to be lenient, and you try to put as much together in order to let it go, to let the whole thing undo, and that she could go free, so to speak.
The ideas of like a lost object, how you.
Yeah.
Isn't there something there to this?
Good segue now to DNA. Thank you. Excellent point. Good segue to DNA. Now that we've been able to look at DNA, and we've used it to free criminal people who are convicted falsely, we've used it, it now has come up as a way of identifying those that have been killed in certain tragedies, like a siman, a sign, a way of identifying, is this my husband or is this not? Where this really came up was 9/11. 100%, 9/11. Okay, so does it work to use a DNA test to find out whether or not, putting aside, you have to put aside a lot of the laws of Aguna here, of maybe you don't even need the DNA, maybe it's just she's fine already once you assume all the factors that went into 9/11. But the basic question of whether DNA would be good to allow someone to go free as an Aguna, that's the basic question. That's the basic question. And therefore, we turn to the first source in the packet. Let's open up the packet. Diane, I'll say the words out loud.
Thanks. I really can't remember.
Okay, and I will translate. You can just follow along. I will translate, and I will tell you where we are.
Even you've got it up near your nose.
Okay. All right. So let's start from page one on the top section. It's got an underline under it, telling you where to go. It's in the left column, page one. Iboilehu, simanin deraisa o derabanan. Using a simon,
a sign,
to identify whether or not this is that person's lost object. It's talking about lost object. The fact that it worked, does that work from the Torah's viewpoint, or was it a rabbinic creation that it works? So the Gemara says, who cares? At the end of the day, we know it works. If there's a sign, it's good. My nafkamina, what's the difference? La dure get isha bisimanim. It works in a case. The reason why you need to know why it's from the Torah or rabbinic is not if you find someone's wallet, but if you find someone's get, a woman's get. It was there. You find it. So you give it back to her based on the simanim that she gives you on it. Listen, it was a get that had on it. I remember there was a coffee. You spilled coffee. You were so distraught. You spilled coffee on the side. What?
But
there could be thousands of people with the same name or whatever it is. But you're giving simanim that make it unique. The Gemara talks all the time about the two Yosef ben Shimons in one city or whatever. So, I amres de'araisa, if it's from the Torah, this idea of identification via a siman, then yeah, give her the get. If it's rabbinic, maybe the rabbis only made a special enactment by monetary, by a wallet that was found. But who says by isura, prohibition, marriage? Who says by that the rabbis went so far as to say a siman is enough? You understand? Maybe the idea of using a siman, a sign, is only good when it comes to monetary. There the rabbis have more control. Why do rabbis have more control? We assume a concept in general, hefker based in hefker. That when it comes to our money, we, if we're Orthodox Jews, we allow sort of implicitly the rabbis to decide at the end of the day where our money should be. It allows the system of paying the right people back to go more smoothly, and that's how we allow it. Hefker based in Hefker. The Beis Din could declare our money ownerless. Okay, it's a way of allowing the judicial system to play itself out. But they don't have that control necessarily when it comes to Isura, deciding who can marry who and what. If we're officially married and someone finds a get on the floor, it might not have been given to me. Meaning it might have your name, but it might not have been given necessarily to you yet.
Oh, I see.
You understand? That's also a factor. Okay. So the Gemara, if you continue by the underlines in the middle of the page, Tashma, Ein me'idim ela al pirtza fapanim imachotem, af al pi sheyesh simanim begufo ubekelav, shma mina simanim lav daraisa. The Gemara entertains the idea of what about identifying via a way a face looks. Oh, I saw the person who was holding it had a button nose and a patch of gray hair that stuck out to the right side of their head. Or whatever it was, some type of simon like that. Okay,
and or you saw the person receive the object.
That would not even be a simon. That's not simon.
No,
that's
edus.
That's testimony.
It's known to have been in their possession prior.
Right, that's chazakas and testimony. We're just talking about simonim. So, along with Tosus and the commentaries, they identify three levels of simonim. There is what's called a simon muvhak, an expert simon. You ever have a Rebbe muvhak? Someone is my expert, my move. Mem, Vav, Beis, Hey, Kuf. muvhak, my expert. There's an expert siman, a mega siman. For example, tell me the shirt that I found, so I know it's yours. Well, the shirt was a size 22. It had on it, it was made 72% cotton, 30%. It had on it, it had your initials in the bottom left corner, and it smelled like, whatever siman. Siman mufak. The middle class is a siman benoni, an average siman. And then there's a siman gerua, a very shvach, a weak siman. Okay, a weak siman.
What's the word for that?
Siman gruim. Gruim is weak.
Actually, it means bad.
Bad. Good.
Yeah.
Shvach. You could see an example. If you look on page 2, which is on the first page, on the right column, there's something called the Magid Mishnah along the side of the Rambam. Rambam is flanked by two commentaries. He has Rav Yosef Cairo on the right-hand side, who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, the Kesef Mishnah. On the left-hand side, he has the Magid Mishnah. So the Magid Mishnah on the left-hand side, where the, you see the hand over there, the hand pointing? It's the first hand pointing on the page. He says, Da, you should know, Sheshlosha mine simonim yesh. There are three types of simonim. Simonim ufakim yosu, the expert ones. What's an example? Nekev yeshpo vetzados ploni. I had a hole right next to the letter Vav. That's a simon mufak. And he says, Harehen ke'edim. It's like witnesses. That's his ironclad. It's like witnesses. That's how strong it is. And everyone agrees that you give back a lost object from the Torah. You give back a lost object if someone produces that. It's on a Torah level. That's how strong it is. What about as far as an aguna? Identifying, they found a body. They see a body and it's decomposed. It's mold. They found someone, barely identify. Or, for example, forget decomposed. Let's say someone saw the body when they were traveling through Poland, and now they come back to the wife when they're in Russia to tell her, we saw Murray in Poland. We saw him. So does a siman count, and what level siman do you need? So the Beit Shmuel, which can be found on the bottom of page 2. See the hand on the right-hand side? It's a little bigger font, slightly bigger. Ayin Chuvas Masos Binyamin. Take a look at the responsa Masos Binyamin. I have that on page 4, the full responsa. V'kosav haklalhu simonim muvhakim shelo yimtze rak echad me'elef. What's a simon muvhak? A 1 in 1,000. It's a probability of a 1 in 1,000 that someone else had the same exact thing that you just described. That's a simon muvhak. For example, Tsovar Akum, hunchback, right? Is it a hunchback? A crimp neck. Tsovar Akum.
No, Tsovar Akum.
A bent neck.
Right.
A hunchback.
Which, that's not exactly the same.
A hunchneck. What's a hunchneck?
There are some people who have a bent neck.
How do you say a neck in Yiddish?
Stump
Bella, first time in years.
Helpful.
A krima helzel. Someone with a krima helzel. A bent neck. It's a good name for a band, krima helzel. Heavy metal. A Yiddish heavy metal band, krima helzel.
I named a band in high school the Rubber Band, B-A-N-N-E-D.
Oh, very good.
Your
band.
we should have a play.
We're going to reform the band, krima helzel. All right. So he says, I bet those things are simon mufak. Okay, those are a siman mufak, that's what he says. 1 in 1,000, and sovar akum. Okay, another example. So he does entertain the possibility of using an expert siman, as you mentioned. Look at page 3. Page 3, this is the Sefer Kobetz Yeshurin. I found this Sefer. They have it, many of them here.
Well, you know what I think it means? I think the medical term is torticollis. Torticollis, that means...
What is that?
In other words, somebody gets a crimp in their neck and they can't hold it straight. I think there's a special Hebrew word for hunchback.
Okay. All right, look into that one for us, Bella. Yeah. Look into that one.
It's easy to know how they did the hunchback of Notre Dame if they translated it.
Yeah, that's what
Hebrew.
I'm... Yeah, right. It's a single word. Yeah.
Okay.
It's,
no, what's the thing where your spine turns into an S?
Spine...
Scoliosis. Scoliosis, that's... Maybe, but anyway.
Okay. The Kobetz Yeshurim brings other opinions as to what's a simon mufak. He brings you other ideas.
This is for identifying a body.
Yeah, for identifying a body. Do we have them here? He gives you more examples. Where is it? I don't spend too much time looking for it. He says everyone agrees that Simanim Mufakim, very expert, are like Aiden. They're like as good as you can get, that kind of thing. He makes a distinction between Simanim and Tvias Ayin. Tvias Ayin is recognition. I recognize the guy. It's your husband. I saw him. Because that's trickier, he said. You can have the situation like, what's that? Remember the play in the movie, Martin Gere? It's called Martin Gere. The Return of Martin Gere.
Oh, yes. I know the one you mean.
You know, where he came back from war and the leg was a little bit longer, but it wasn't him. You don't know even until the end if it was him.
I didn't see
it. Yes, I know.
Pardieu? I don't know.
Wasn't it, the hideous anti-Semite and Jodie Foster? Mel Gibson and Jodie Foster.
What? That was something else.
Mel Gibson and Jodie Foster.
That wasn't this. No, it was...
He comes back from the Civil War looking different, but it isn't...
Okay. Trust me. Yeah.
I shouldn't know.
Yeah.
But
trust me.
It's no badge of honor. Not like quoting the
That's
source.
Funny.
Okay.
You could have a twin.
What?
A much simpler answer is you could have a twin.
Right. Exactly. It could be a twin, which doesn't help you either. Okay. So now, fine. So that's worse than a simon. A simon is something that never would have been in your head to begin with. He had a horn coming out of his head. The fact that you came up with that and you nailed the very person that is my husband, that's stronger. When you do tfiyas ayin, recognition, that's already, listen, in the right sunlight, anybody looks like. Everyone thinks they saw this person, that person. You don't really know. And you don't know.
Everybody thinks
there's a difference.
Here.
Yeah.
In other words, you know, it's like when somebody says to me, I don't know, do you go to the Jewish center? There's somebody there who goes, looks exactly like you. Is that what you're talking about?
Everybody has their evil twin, you know that theory?
Yes.
Is there evil Bella there?
No, I was once in a restaurant.
Your doppelganger, it's called in the comic book.
I was once in a restaurant, yeah. Erev Tisha B'Av in Israel, and it was crowded, and a guy's sharing the table, and he says, I was wearing a big hat, he says, excuse me, you must have heard this a million times before, but you look exactly like Elizabeth Taylor.
I sorry, I didn't hear you. What did you say?
I would have said
okay.
Say it slowly, please.
Another option is that he mentions the three levels of the different simonim, and at the end you have this discussion, are simonim deraisa or derabanan? What are the different categories? I might just pay to look at it a little bit here. There's some good stuff in here. He says, "Jazioi al identification al yedei DNA beheter agunos." So tluyim rabos begedriv densimon. It's going to depend very much so on the definition of simanim. So the poskim established a rule that there are shlosha suge simanim yesh. There are three types of simanim: simanim gruim, simanim benonim, simanim uvakim. Each one has its own set of rules. Weak simanim, like for example, I saw him; he's tall. Or that was my pot. It was white, or it was black, something like that. That work doesn't even work for Ashava Saveda, a Simon Grua. Simon Benoni, that's the Gemara is unsure about, the middle category, if it's Deraisa or if it's Derabanan. What's the difference? The difference we said in the Gemara was about giving back the get, and that the Gemara is unsure about. But the one that's from the Torah, though, is a simonim muvhakim. The majority of poskim believe that even if you hold that simonim are not from the Torah, if you have a simon muvhak, a clear simon, that's deraisa. That's deraisa. The only technical machlokas, which I'm not going to spend more than a second on, is whether, though, however, yes, it is a simon muvhak, but it's still a simon. Or do we say once it's a simon mufak, it leaves the category of even being called a simon? Simon means a sign. Maybe it's not even a sign anymore. It is. It is the reality. It's not even a indicator of the reality. It becomes the reality. And there are differences in that discussion whether or not, you know, what's the deal or not.
But it has to be established beforehand, meaning the guna has to explain what the sign is and then the person's found. Or let's say, you know, they present someone and said, this is your husband. And then she sees a sign.
No. That might not work. It might not work. You need to present. You need to present. Exactly. 100%.
Okay.
What comes up more often than not is the co-joining of simonim. because you don't always have a siman mufak available. So what comes up is the co-joining of simanim. And the Ramah, back on page 2, the Ashkenazic authority on the, it's the middle section, it's the bottom section of Halachas. It's the underline, it's the, you see the bottom section says Shulchan Aruch? And in the top section of the bottom piece, there's a hand pointing. It's pointing to the Ramah, which is the Ashkenazic Psak. And he says, Afilu Kuf Simanim, even if 100 Simanim, She'ein Mufakim, which are not expert, Ein Oklum, doesn't mean anything. If you have 100 pieces of marginal evidence, symbols, oh, my husband was wearing a jacket, I saw a jacket. If you have 100 symbols, it doesn't mean anything. So what we're not sure of, that statement in the Ramah, was he referring to the weak symbols, or was he referring to the mid-range ones? Right? Saying you have 100 not expert simonim means nothing, says the Shulchan Aruch, Ramah. Is that referring to the middle level ones or the baseline, the bottom level ones? Which one was he referring to? So the Beis Shmuel, again, quotes the Masas Binyamin, who says, no, he only meant by the real weak ones do 100 of them not add up. But mid-range simanim, decent average simanim, can add up to make a much superior, to make a superior simon.
The case together.
They can't. They put right to put the case together.
How about these drawings when people describe a person, a criminal?
Oh, excellent, excellent. I'm going to talk about that also. Excellent, okay. Excellent. So the Chelkos Mechokek disagrees. He says no. It meant even the mid-level stuff is not good at all, as is not good as well. Bottom line. This comes up very interesting. Oh, you go to page 10. You have page 10 over there.
Are these just relating just to Agunos?
What?
This is Agunos stuff?
I want to apply it directly by Agunos.
I'm saying that's what they're not dealing with identification in general. They're just dealing with Agunos?
Well, where else would it come up? Let's assume for now we know nothing else besides lost objects.
A guy, you know, you think you saw somebody commit a crime and you're,
I'm going to keep that separate from now because it's very, that's going to be very tricky
but
how
in
it applies.
The context of
yes,
this
is relevant as well. Just by the way, bottom left, so you see what's coming. It says, Heter Agunot Memigdalei HaTeumim, the Twin Towers in New York. Let's leave that aside for right now. On page 10, what you have on page 10 over here is a piece called Sugyot Behilchas Tzava Umishtara. Sugyos in the laws of the army and the police. Okay, army and police issues. This is where Greg comes into play, what Greg just brought up. Criminal issues. If you look
I just
at
wrote that up.
Page 10.
You wrote up.
What?
I wrote up the criminal drawings. Greg
right, the great.
Asked the context.
Does this apply to it? So now. So we say over here. This is a far-reaching piece over here. It's got a lot of different applications, and he really gets into the nitty-gritty of DNA. And he says
who's
as follows.
He?
What?
Who's the he?
Rav Levinson wrote the Sefer on Hilchas Tzava Mishtara, the laws of police and laws of army and police. So he says on the top left corner of his section, Nechleku Achronim, if it's talking that 100 don't co-join, does it mean only by the weak stuff or is it also by the mid-range stuff? So he quotes the Masas Binyamin and then he quotes the Machlokas on that we just saw that it's unclear and the Chelkos Mechokek disagrees. Be Shmuel be Masas Binyamin. The rule is as follows. How do you know who to follow when there's all these different opinions? The rule many times is you always follow the last person in that unit is always the one who's most right. Doesn't mean the later is most right, because if you have someone who's in the period called the Rishonim, meaning the period that ends like around 1400, versus someone going up against someone from the 1700s, the 1400 guy will always win. But if it's someone who is 1224 versus right at the end of the Rishonim period, 1398, the 1398 will win. Why? Because he takes into account all the opinions in that section before him when coming to the conclusion. That's a rule. Halacha kabasrai. The halacha is always like the later one. Doesn't mean like the guy from 2010. It means the later one in that category of poskim. Leis Rishonim, Leis Achronim, so on and so forth. So he says, Halacha lemaisa, mekablim achronei haposkim et shitas hamasbin. The later poskim seem to accept the Masas Binyamin and say that we collect 100 or many mid-range simanim, and that'll be good enough. Again, you see this idea that when it comes to the aguna, we do whatever we can to be lenient because this is a disaster of a situation. You try to put some. We'll be an example. For example, a mid-range siman is that my husband's right earlobe was longer than his left earlobe. That's an example the Noda Behuda brings as a mid-range siman. You could add that together with another one, and this is how the Chasam Sofer Paskins we use this.
How about
you know this comes up also by an Esrog. You use this when you're talking about an Etrog. This comes up. That's how this is relevant.
Today I was at YIVA.
Hello, welcome.
I've cataloged registers of survivors. Does that written evidence count?
What do you mean, what is it?
In other words, in the Holocaust, there were these lists, you know, before they had the Yad Vashem database. Does that count, a written record of
written
a death?
Written records, no.
Written record of a death or written records
it's used
of
as a sniff. It's co-joined as a sniff lahakel. It's not definitive in any way. Because anybody,
that's
people
so
put down names all the time and people... popped up that were on lists. There, you have tons of stories.
I found that for my mother-in-law's first husband in Drancy. I found it in Le Mémorial de la Déportation des Juifs de France.
Oh.
She never had written evidence. She had hearsay that he had died. And I was cataloging the book of Evo.
Fascinating.
And I found it.
Fascinating.
With David and Uriel, he got divorced, I think you were telling me, before.
Who?
Wasn't it David and Uriel?
Before you go out to war, to battle,
right.
The Gemara talks about how everyone wrote a get al tanai, so to speak,
yes.
A temporary get in case the war situation happened.
People who traveled
war,
get that also.
That's one of those workarounds of the problem. Yeah.
So back then they were already
but
writing.
But we don't do that anymore. Yeah, no one would do that for hundreds of years since the time. That was in the time of David they did that. They wrote these getting during the war because you don't know if you're going to come back.
Even though there was still polygamy then.
What?
Even though there was polygamy.
Yeah. Even though
yeah, a lot
he
of
could
people
married
took
a second person. He didn't.
No, but the problem is, if what if he doesn't come back so that she can marry someone else? It was written so the men would have it, so the wives
gotcha.
Could marry. Yeah, it was for
gotcha,
them.
Gotcha.
So the women
yeah.
would have it.
Yeah.
MIA, MIA.
Exactly. So now, he gets the DNA in the bottom. Avale'inyan zihoi korbanos asun. Those that were the tragic ones, those that were the korbanos, that were really...
9/11.
Alpi shinayim, using their teeth, identifying via the teeth. Tvias etzbos and DNA, b'derech klal medubar besimonim gruim.
So tvias etzbos.
He calls it
fingerprints.
Yes, he calls DNA excellent. Tvias etzbos fingerprints excellent. Shkoyach Bella. He calls them DNA as a weak simon. What? What in the world? Couldn't think of a stronger simon in the world. OJ, right? That was the OJ defense that someone else in Honduras could have the same blood DNA. Right? That was the defense, that someone else could have the same blood. There was one person
was
at the end
the
of the
gloves.
World.
Gloves.
What?
The gloves
didn't fit.
If the glove don't fit, you have to quit. Now, let's continue reading. We have to understand if he's right, if anybody agrees to this, where does this come from, so on and so forth. So, rak le'itim rechokos, in distant cases, yesh b'simani hashinayim, mikre nadir shel stima me'od, miuchedesh, shel stima ziyocholia kesima benini. Many times, in rare instances, can the identification of the teeth serve as a mid-level siman, along with another siman, miyucheshi kesim mufal al prosim and say abu derech klam medur simanim gruim benimtsa shenalu delas heter al pizio madai. This whole scientific heter is sort of tvias etzbos of DNA. Rak mik simanim eshinayim atamacher DNA yem meod miyuchadim. You need these things to be very, very unique. Very, very unique, but in general, no good.
Where are you reading this?
Right at the bottom left corner of page 10. He does not...
He can't be right, because that's not how they possibly...
Rav Levinson does not like it. He doesn't think it works. He says it's not reliable. What does it mean, doesn't work? We have to figure out what that means. Why is this simon grua? Okay, why does it... You know, what does it mean? So let's assume he's right for a second, that it is a weak simon, a simon grua. Let's assume that he's right... that it is a weak simon. Okay? So the question is whether we could still use it as something or to chuck it out. Could it still be used as something? Meaning, could a simon gerua, a weak simon, still serve as something? So if you look in the Shalos Hatshuvos Ein Yitzchak on page 5, remember we called him the father of the agunas. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spektrum. He was along way before we had DNA. So he's not talking about DNA, but I think the premise of using a grua comes from here.
So is Yeshiva University named after him?
The Ritz is, the smicha place. Yeah. He brings a proof from Tosfos that two simanim gruim, two weak simanim, can co-join to a middle. Can be co-joined to be a middle. On the other hand, he quotes a Tshuva Sarash that says, not that way. So he brings you both sides over there, and there's two sides over here. Okay. So what I want to leave that with, and where we leave off with today, okay, we'll leave with today, is we've set up the situation of what is DNA. We talked about what is an aguna, why it's such a rare and difficult and painful, and what makes it so unique as a halachic system, the concept of DNA. The first place, aguna, the first place we decided to solve the aguna problem is we're not here to solve all the aguna problems. That's a different shir, a different series. We're here to look at it from one direction, and that's DNA. The route we wanted to take was first the concept of looking at simonim in general, identifying lost objects. And we played into the fact that the idea of a simon working, does it work from a Torah standpoint or rabbinic standpoint? That question's relevant to tell us whether to extend the topic of simonim outside the realm of monetary issues. And we said there's three levels. Simonim muvhakim, everyone agrees, that's from the Torah. That's perfect. That'll work across the board. Simonim gruim, the bottom ones, being bad, that doesn't even work by a Shavas Aveda, by money. The Beinoni, the middle ones, unclear which way it goes. We saw Machlokis, Masas, Binyamin, Athelkis, Machokik, whether you can add several Beinonim together to make a positive. Chelkis Machokik says no. Masas Binyamin said yes. And we saw many Chasim Sofer, many others say, you paskin like the Masas Binyamin. If you collect many mid-level simonim, you could help her out. You could help up the guna. That's when we're now ready to turn to DNA. And the first Mar Makom we saw, without logic behind it, we just saw the statement. We don't have the logic yet. The first statement was from the Sefer, this Kobetz, where it collected on the different, for Mishtara and Sava, on the army. He said basically that DNA is like a simon grua, which we accepted that premise temporarily and asked ourselves, well, maybe a simon grua could be added to a mid-range simon, and together they can make something nice. And we said that possibility plays itself out into a separate machlokus between the Tosis and the Rosh. So what we want to try to do next time is look at DNA and see whether or not we can upgrade DNA from the get-go. If we see that there are poskim who see DNA as a viable option, as a more powerful simon, and if they don't, why don't they? And if they do, why do they? What's the source of their debate? And then we'll go from there into other areas of DNA in Jewish law. Let's stop there.